Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim. Today, I wanted to bring you a taste of the kinds of sessions that we had at the Apologetics Canada Conference 2018, which was held on March 2nd and 3rd of this year at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia, where we operate out of. And so I thought I would play for you one of the breakout sessions. Now, this breakout session was given by Dr. Andy Bannister, who's a good friend of ours. He is the director of SOLA Center for Public Christianity in the UK. As well, he is an adjunct speaker with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Fantastic speaker, great sense of humor, just all around a very pleasant person to be with. The session that he taught was entitled, Does Religion Poison Everything? This was a very apt session to teach because this came the day after his dialogue on the Foundation for Human Rights with Justin Trottier, who was our secular and atheist speaker representing the secular humanist position on the question of the Foundation for Human Rights. So let me play for you the entirety of the breakout session taught by Andy Bannister. Now, if you like what you hear, there are more sessions like that. If you go to our website, apologeticscanada.com/store, you can actually purchase the entire digital recordings package from the Apologetics Canada Conference 2018, as well as the previous years. All of the conferences that we've had since year 2011, I believe. And so you can go there and check that out. And so without further ado, here is Dr. Andy Bannister teaching on Does Religion Poison Everything?
Last night after the dialogue with JT and JB, I was in the car back to the hotel, and Justin Trottier was in the same car as me, and with Justin Brierley, actually, and we were chatting. And so Justin Trottier says to me, so, you know, what are you doing at the rest of the conference? And I said, oh, I'm doing two seminars, two breakout sessions tomorrow. He said, oh, what are your breakout sessions on? And I said, well, I'm looking at the topic of does religion poison everything? And he went, oh, what a fascinating topic. Does it? And then I surprised him by saying, well, actually, I said, my answer might not be the one you think, but there we are. So everyone's interested in this topic. And you know, I'm reminded of the fact that when I moved to Canada in 2010, I now live back in the UK, but for 6 years I lived in Toronto. And so in 2010, shortly after we moved to Toronto, there was a debate took place at Roy Thompson Hall in Toronto. And the debate took place between the two gentlemen on the screen behind me. On the left-hand side, that is the well-known evangelist and apologist, Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK. That was a joke, by the way. And on the right-hand side, that is not an ancient version of Andy Steiger. That is, in fact, Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, the then well-known atheist philosopher. And those two had a debate. They locked horns over on this topic. The topic of the debate that evening was, is religion a force for good in the world? And tickets for the event sold out. In fact, they were scalping tickets outside Roy Thompson Hall for $500. That's almost more than tickets go for a Leafs game. And in fact, Tony Blair did as well as the Leafs traditionally did that night because he lost badly. And I need to be careful, though, because those guys are almost at the top of the league, which is terrifying. I have so many Leafs jokes. If they ever win, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll have to sort of give up my speaking career, at least in Canada. Anyway, without a doubt, Hitchens won the crowd that evening and won the debate. He did really, really well. And his thesis was simple. Multiple times throughout the debate, and since then he said it in print on numerous occasions, this was Hitchens' line, religion poisons everything. And it's a very clever line. It's very memorable. It's very tweetable. It's very kind of sort of simple, straightforward, easy to sort of trips off the tongue really, really well. Religion poisons everything. Now, was he right? Well, certainly at least he's not alone in seeing a problem here. Although he was the one who sort of coined perhaps this most memorable version of the idea, many, many people think that the world would be better off without religion. So, for example, take someone like John Lennon, you know, the singer, the songwriter. John Lennon wrote very, very famous song called Imagine. It's become almost something of a secular anthem. Probably many of you here are familiar with the lyrics, but let me read them to you. And just to bless you, I'm going to read them, not sing them, because that would have you running for the emergency exits. So John Lennon wrote these words. He said, "Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today." He goes on, "Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion to. Imagine all the people living life in peace." And I know many kind of secularists who've adopted this almost as a kind of sort of creed, almost as a hymn, really. You know, wouldn't it be wonderful? Think about a world without religion. And so the question I want to explore, really, over the next 40 minutes or so is was John Lennon right? Is Christopher Hitchens right? Does religion poison everything? Well, I surprised Justin last night by saying, I actually think there's something in this, because I think that only a fool would disagree with the idea that religion can cause all kinds of damage. Religion can go badly wrong and cause tremendous harm. You only have to turn on the television news or read the newspapers or surf the internet to find near daily examples. Religion can cause violence, religion can cause injustice, religion can cause harm, can cause intolerance. But in one sense, pointing that out and saying things like religion poisons everything is too easy. It's rather like just sort of shooting fish in a barrel, really. I'm more interested in a deeper question. What is it about religion that can cause it to go wrong? Why does religion sometimes cause the problems that it does? Well, arguably, it's because religion allows you to very easily divide the world into two. Religion allows you to divide the world into them and us. You know, people like me, people not like me. And the moment you divide the world into them and us, it's very, very easy to discriminate, to be hateful, to be negative, to be intolerant towards those who are not like you, who are not part of your group. And religion makes that pretty easy to do that. But the problem, of course, and where I think Hitchens was only sort of onto part of the truth, is the problem runs much deeper than that, because human beings seem to have this sort of, sort of inbuilt tendency, natural tendency to divide people into groups like that. Back in the 1960s, a Polish psychologist called Henry Tajfel ran what has now become, certainly in psychology, a very famous set of experiments. He took a group of university students and he had them all toss a coin. And he divided the students into groups, depending upon whether they got heads or tails. So he split the group of students into two groups purely randomly, just based on a coin toss. And once he divided his students into two groups, he then asked volunteers from the groups to divide resources between themselves. And some versions of the experiments, he would do money. Sometimes he tried candy, sometimes just points, I mean, just a purely arbitrary number. And what he showed time and time again was that people had a tendency to allocate more of the resource, the money, the candy, or the points, to their own group and less to the other, even though it was purely random, just a coin toss that had set those two groups up. And his thesis was that human beings seem to have had this tendency to play in-group, out-group games. It seems to be something about our psychology, something about the way that we're wired. Now, of course, talking of wired, roll the historical lens forward 50 years, and we come to this wonderful world of digital technology that we live in today, which has actually made the problem worse. It's interesting, back in the early 1990s, when the internet was beginning, you can read the sort of utopian statements of sort of founders of the internet, someone like Tim Berners-Lee, who's the British scientist who invented the World Wide Web, and so who we have to thank for Wikipedia and cat memes and all of this kind of stuff. And you can see Tim, 30 years ago, saying he believed that this technology, the World Wide Web that he had invented, would bring peace and harmony and tolerance, because it would bring people together. He didn't live in the age of Twitter, where this is not really the case, if we're honest with ourselves. Technology has actually made it much easier to divide into tribes and attack other people. You only have to spend sort of 5 or 10 minutes on Twitter, and you see this to be the case. In fact, there's even a term that technologists have coined for this. It's called digital flocking. We have this tendency to flock together into kind of digital tribes and gang up on the others. In fact, there was a piece of research done About 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, during the last American election, last American presidential election, you know, the absolute highest pinnacle of Western liberal democracy. And during that that election, researchers looked at the behavior of groups on the internet of Republicans and groups of Democrats, and they found that both sides, right and left, did the same thing. They hung out online with people like them. They only posted articles and commentary from newspapers that thought like them. They demonized the other, and each side thought the other president, the other candidate was almost sort of Satan incarnate. And it demonstrated this beautifully. And the interesting thing is, all of us have this tendency to do this. Probably many of you in this room, if you're honest with yourselves, and even if you're not honest with each other, you probably think that perhaps you're slightly smarter than the average Canadian. That's why you're at the Apologetics Canada conference, of course. Or you think that you're better looking. Or that your accent is nicer. I know mine is, but maybe you think yours is. Or you think you're more politically progressive, or more compassionate, or more devout, or better read, or whatever it is. We all have a tendency to divide society into like that, and to usually sort of think of ourselves in slightly superior tendency. We all do it. We divide the world into them and us, good people and bad people, the right people and the wrong people. And of course, we always place ourselves on the good side of the line. Every single one of us, because we're part of this wonderfully complex tribe, the human race, has a tendency to be divisive and to be intolerant. And so my biggest problem, my number one problem with the claim that religion poisons everything, is it doesn't go far enough. It only begins to scratch at the surface. There is something much deeper going on. And in fact, we can illustrate by taking a look at Christopher Hitchens' little statement, religion poisons everything, and doing a little thought experiment. What would happen if we took the word religion out of that statement and replaced it with another word? For example, let's replace it with the word money. Money poisons everything. I think I can make a case that money poisons everything. Money causes jealousy and envy and crime. Money causes consumption and consumerism. It damages the environment. Money allows people to buy Justin Bieber's music. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Money poisons everything. I think I could mount that thesis. Or what about politics? You know, politics causes division. It causes hatred, it causes enmity, it causes intolerance, it causes political leaders to tweet ludicrous things at 3 a.m, it causes other political leaders to go to India and dress up as goodness knows what. I mean, the list goes on. I used to say that President Trump was the gift that keeps on giving, but God bless Justin Trudeau. Just please don't look at British politics right now either. I think politics poisons everything. I think we can mount that case. Or about science? I think I can mount the case that science poisons everything. I mean, sure, science has given us the cure for cancer and Sheldon Cooper, but there's a whole list of other things that science has given us. It's given us, it's led to the death of millions through development of weapons. It's given us environmental damage. It's given us biological warfare agents. It's given us the atomic bomb, and so on and so forth. And the more you do this little thought experiment, the more you begin to realize there's a problem going on. And the problem, in a sense, is not science. And the problem is not money, and the problem is not politics, and the problem isn't religion. Those are just the symptoms. Those are just the symptoms of a much bigger problem. The problem isn't out there somewhere. The problem is closer to home. The problem is in here somewhere. There's a very human problem, because what those things, politics and science and money and religion, have in common is human beings. And it seems that everything that human beings grab hold of, we can use for great good, and we can also use it for great evil. We pick up things like science and we use it for good, but on the next breath we use it for evil. And we do the same with all of these things. As human beings, we seem to have this ability to be angelic and also to be monstrous. You know, the person whom I think recognized this the most of almost any writer I've ever read was a gentleman called Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Some of you may be familiar with his name. He was a Russian political activist who, in the beginning of the middle part of the 20th century, was imprisoned by the communists in the former Soviet Union for his political beliefs and sentenced to about 20 years in prison doing hard labor there in the gulags. And after he was released, he wrote an incredibly influential book called the Gulag Archipelago, one of the longest books I've ever read. It's almost 1,000 pages. It's so big you could beat elephants to death with it. Actually, if Justin Trottier were here with animal rights, let's not go there. Big book. Anyway, big book. And That book, interestingly as well, has been credited with being one of the major sort of things that began to cause a crack in communism, because many people in the West, particularly on the sort of perhaps on the slightly more progressive end of politics, back at that time in history, sort of had a tendency not to, to sort of overlook a lot of the abuses of the Soviet system. And after Alexander's book, no one could. Well, in that book, it's very interesting. You would have thought that he would put the boot into communism. I mean, here's he's writing a book about his experiences, about 20 years in prison, incredible hardships and solitary confinement. You know, what a wonderful opportunity to describe the evils of communism. Well, he doesn't take that route. He doesn't go for that particular piece of low-hanging fruit. Instead, he writes something far more insightful on the human condition and the whole question of evil. Let me read you what Alexander Solzhenitsyn had to say. Very famous quotation. Some of you may have heard this before. He wrote, "The line between good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but it passes right through the middle of every human heart and through all human hearts." In other words, he's saying every human being has the ability to be good as well as be evil. All of us have this dividing line running through the middle of our lives. And that can be pretty uncomfortable, because I meet many people, I think it's the sort of standard sort of default response, really, that most of us are wedded as human beings to the idea that we are sort of pretty decent people, kind of bait when you get underneath us. But each of us, if we're honest, is a lot more complex than that. If you are like I am, and we're all a member of the human family, you know, if I'm honest with myself, I can be cruel as well as kind. I can be mean as well as munificent. I can be as quick to hold a grudge as I can be to forgive. I can be petty and spiteful at times as well as generous. I can be compassionate one moment, the very next moment, very willing to rejoice when somebody else fails. And the same goes for each one of you in this room, and in fact, every human being, because human beings are a marvelously diverse and complex tribe, and collective responsibility catches us all up in the end. And every single human being, at some point in our lives, will find ourselves falling on one side of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's line or the other side. So if that's the case, if religion isn't the problem, but humanity is the problem, that raises the question of how do we solve it? How do we overcome our tendency to play in-group, out-group games, to divide people into them and us, to feel superior, to be intolerant, to look down on and exclude others? How do we solve the problem? Well, let me begin by one word that you often hear thrown around in contemporary culture as the solution that I think is a non-solution, so I just want to deal with it right at the start. Some people will tell you, well, what we need is tolerance. What we need is if human beings were just more tolerant, if we were more tolerant to other people, then we'd have rainbows and kittens and unicorns and universal peace and harmony and donuts for everybody or something. Now, I'm a great believer in being iconoclastic because I'm British, and also I often speak to more hostile audiences than this one, such as Methodists, for example. And I insulted Baptists and Anglicans last night, so my task this afternoon is to offend the rest of the lot of you. And I like to be iconoclastic, especially when speaking on university campuses. And so I hope I don't shock anybody this afternoon by saying, look, if I could remove one word from the dictionary, I would remove the word tolerance. Well, actually, I'd firstly remove the word goat's cheese because it's evil. But then I'd remove the word tolerance. Why would I remove the word tolerance? Why do I hate the word tolerance? I think it's a ludicrous word. Well, what do we mean by tolerance? Usually, when we use the word tolerance, we mean we are treating with sort of generosity something that's sort of beneath us, something that can't quite meet our standards, but we give it a free pass because it's not quite as smart as we are. Let me give you an illustration. I have a 5-year-old daughter and I have a 2.5-year-old son. My 2.5-year-old son, Christopher, about 3 months ago, basically discovered innate artistic tendencies, and he discovered the joy of crayons and felt tips and pens. He hasn't yet discovered the joy of paper. And so Chris is expressing himself artistically on walls, doors, the floor, his bed clothes, his own face, his sister's face on at least one occasion. But you know what? We're working with him, but we also tolerate that. He's a toddler. You can't expect better. You hope that one day, maybe when he's 18, he may have grown out of this, but you know, so be it. Or, you know, you tolerate the family dog when it wheezes on the couch for the third time in a month because it's a dog, it doesn't know any better. See what we're saying here? Tolerance is what you do for something that can't come up to your standards. It's not your intellectual equal. On the other hand, when you meet somebody who's an adult like you are, but just thinks very, very differently, I put it to you that to suggest that you should be tolerating them is incredibly patronizing, outrightly arrogant, and downright rude. Because we shouldn't be tolerating people who are different to us. We should be listening to people who are different to us. We should be engaging them as equals and engaging in conversation, taking their views seriously, even if we disagree. And I've suggested to you that nobody, I suspect, in this room actually wants to be tolerated. What you want to do is you want people to listen to you and take you seriously, consider your views, treat you as an adult, and in order to understand you so that you might understand them. No human being actually really wants to be tolerated. So let's forget about tolerance. Let's metaphorically rip it out of the dictionary and throw it into the bin along with the word goat's cheese and move on. And don't do the goat's cheese joke ever again. Now, where should we go? Well, this gets us into a territory that we talked about last night, which is why this sort of topic that I'm doing this lunchtime coheres nicely with some of the ground that Justin and I talked about last night. I think what we actually need to solve a lot of the problems in the world, of which the religion is merely a symptom, we need a real concrete basis for human dignity. We need a real basis to treat one another with respect, with care, to listen to those we disagree with. We need some kind of basis for that. We need some kind of basis for treating people as our equals, whether or not their views agree with ours. So let me read you a short paragraph. We talked about this last night. In fact, Justin Brierley quoted a little bit of it, but we didn't throw it on the screen. So let me throw up on the screen for you the preamble to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or the UDHR, if you are the kind of person who likes acronyms. And let me read these hugely important words to you. This is one of the founding documents that stands behind our modern human rights tradition. And it reads like this. Recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom and justice and peace in the world. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Now, noble as those words sound, and as we explored this area a little bit last night, the question that is begged here is, are those noble-sounding words actually true? Can you give reasons for them? About 2, maybe 3 years ago, I was doing an event at a university in Ontario. I think it was McMaster University Medical School in Hamilton, just to the west of Toronto. And the event, I think, was on sort of, you know, evidence for Christianity or some such topic that apologists like to talk on from time to time. And at the end of the event, a young man came down the aisle to speak to me. I'm realizing I'm in my mid-40s when I refer to university students as a young man. So game over, isn't it, really? Okay, a student, let's reclaim my youth, came down the aisle to talk to me. And his opening line, before even hello, was, "I hate Christians." I thought, well, this is going to go well. This is a great start to the conversation. And so I thought, well, you know, nothing to lose, really. So I said, oh, interesting, why? He said, well, I hate you Christians because you're anti-gay, anti-transgender, anti-progress, anti-science, anti-environment, anti-women, and then anti about half a dozen other things that I can't actually remember, but apparently I was anti them, even though I'd never heard of them before. Anyway, he finished his little kind of rant, and he kind of looked at me, sort of saw steam kind of rising, sort of anger coming off him from the red mist that had descended. And I found myself thinking, my word, what do I say? And he'd actually got, there's a crowd now. You could see people gathering around to listen because they obviously thought this was the after-show entertainment, you know, Christian meets lion or something. And and so again, being British and being iconoclastic, I looked at him and I said, the last thing he'd said was anti-women. So I looked at him and I said, what's wrong with being anti-women? Oh, I wish I could have taken a photo of his face. It was, it was a bit like a kind of fish out of water. He was like, and then when he sort of regained his composure, he went, well, because it is. I thought, well, this is a great kind of level of, you know, intellectual discourse. So I said, no, it isn't. Why is it? I said, no, why is it? He went, well, it is. Well, but why is it? Because it is. We did that 3 or 4 times. I went, come on. I said, here you are, at McMaster University Medical School, a program with a massive waiting list. The fact you're here tells me you must be one of the brilliant minds of your generation in Canada. You can do better than that. So he thought about it, and he said, well, it's wrong to discriminate against people. I said, you've just reworded the question. You've just changed women to people. Why is it wrong to discriminate against people? And we went to and fro for about 5 minutes. He would offer me reasons, and then I would play the annoying five-year-old and just ask the why question. And interesting, finally he looked at me, and he said, this is frustrating. I kind of know that it's wrong. I know that it's wrong, but I can't tell you why. Why can't I? And I said, interesting. I said, you may think all kinds of things about Christianity. I said, but I do firmly believe that it gives you a foundation for what you're looking for and that your particular worldview doesn't. I said, but that aside, I said, tell me, what are you training for here at the medical school? What are you hoping to do as a career? He said, oh, I'm hoping to be a surgeon. I want to cut people open. So I'm not sure that's the way I'd advertise that particular, you know, but I see where you're at. Okay, so I said, let's imagine you achieve that dream. I said, you will end up with responsibility over patients. You will end up with all kinds of power. Doctors have incredible, incredible power, even more than CRA officials. And I said, you may find yourself tempted as a doctor to do something stupid. That's why we have medical ethics. And I said, if you find yourself tempted to do something stupid or inappropriate to or involving a patient, all I can say is I hope by that point you find a far better basis for your ethics than it's wrong because it's wrong because it's wrong. Because, excuse me for being this direct, I said to him, otherwise, God help your patients. Interesting, he looked at me and he said, I still don't agree with you, he said, but you have given me a lot to think about. I need to think about these things. So I took that as at least half a win. You see, if there is no God, if we live in a world where matter is just the ultimate reality, then as we were exploring last night, human rights really is just a fiction. It's a beautiful fiction. It's a lovely, lovely fairy tale, but it's ultimately just a myth. Because if the material world is all there is, then each one of you here this afternoon is just a random collection of atoms, a random assortment of molecules, and you have no more value, no more inherent dignity than any other collection of atoms. Perhaps a collection of atoms that's appearing to us as a dog, or a table, or a Justin Bieber CD, or an elephant turd. You know, the list goes on. And saying that one set of atoms, one that looks like a human being, has a special set of rights or dignity that another set of atoms doesn't, well, quite frankly, it's laughably absurd. It makes no coherent sense. And that's why I, and in fact many, many other philosophers and thinkers, many of them not Christian, incidentally, think and would say that the only foundation that can really support human rights theory and dignity is the Christian worldview that can support this idea that human beings are precious and have value. Now, of course, if Justin Trottier were here, he'd be saying, well, Andy, of course you say this. You're a Christian. You know, you're biased. I go, no, I'm biased because I'm British. But, you know, that's another angle entirely. Thank you, one person. And but to show that this is not just me saying this as a Christian in front of you this afternoon, let me read to you some words from a gentleman called Raymond Gaitar. Raymond Gaitar is an Australian philosopher, and he's an atheist. He's a committed atheist. And nevertheless, this is what he writes. Raymond writes, he says, We may say that all human beings are inestimably precious. We may say that they are owed unconditional respect. We may say that they possess inalienable dignity. And in my judgment, though, these are ways of trying to say what we feel and need to say when we are estranged from the conceptual resources we need to say it. Be that as it may, each is problematic and each is contentious. Not one of them has the simple power of the religious ways of speaking. Now, which religious ways of speaking is the atheist Australian philosopher Raymond Gaitar talking about here? Well, he's talking about this text that we talked about a little bit last night, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, where we read, "So God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." And it's interesting that only the Bible pays you the compliment of telling you that you are made in the image of God. You will not find that claim in the Quran. I've been studying the Quran academically for 20 years. The Quran does not make that claim. You won't find that claim in the foundational texts of Buddhism. nor in the Vedas of Hinduism, nor will you find it in the writings of Confucius or in any atheist text. Only the Bible tells you that you're made in the image of God. Only the Bible is very clear that to be a human being is not just to be atoms and particles, is not just to be a collection of molecules or an accident of biology. Rather, you and I and every human being is made in the image of God, and that means we have inherent value, infinite value, value in fact so great that God would pay that infinite price that he paid to forgive and to restore and to redeem and to rescue us when he stepped into history and went to the cross in the person of Jesus. So in order to deal with this problem that we have of excluding one another, of playing in-group, out-group games, of dividing people, of which religion is just one part of the problem, we need a foundation for dignity, for treating others who are not like us with care and compassion. And I think Christianity and the Christian worldview offers that. But we need something else as well. There's one other piece of the jigsaw that is often overlooked, and that's the whole idea of humility. I want to talk a little bit about humility this afternoon. One reason I love talking about humility is I am, in fact, the most humble person in the entire world, standing before you. Oh, hang on a minute. There's a problem with that, isn't there? I'm joking, by the way. Please don't tweet that. Bannister just said. See, in order to deal with this human tendency to exclude one another, to divide people, to be vicious to those not like ours, yes, we need a basis for human dignity, but we need a basis for something else. We need something that gives us a foundation for humility, for undercutting this tendency we have to think more highly of ourselves than others. We all have this tendency to do this as human beings. It's very, very easy to do that, to look down on others. For example, being British, I tend to naturally look down on everybody. It's a kind of British tendency. You know, we built a great empire on that basis. As they said, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire, because not even God trusted the British in the dark is actually the reason for that. But then, of course, slightly closer to home, here in Canada, right? There's a sort of friendly Canadian tendency to look down slightly on your crazy southern cousins across the border. You know, look at their crazy politics. You know, they're mad down there. Look at their gun laws. You know, thankfully, we've got none of that in Canada. We've got a prime minister who goes to Asia, and actually, let's not go there. And you know, it's sobering, actually, to sort of mentally ask yourself the question, or sort of say the sentence to yourself in your mind, I am better than, and notice how quickly you can find a noun to complete the end of the sentence. Most of us, if we are honest, have a sort of slight sort of smug quality at times that we think there are people that we're better than, even though we wouldn't be Canadian and actually say that. And this is one of the problems with religion. See, most people think, and many religions function on this basis, of saying that religion is all about being good. You know, religion is about being good and moral and keeping God's commandments and being spiritual and holy and righteous and moral and upright and so forth. But the problem is, if that's what religion is, it quickly leads to a sense of superiority. For example, if you are a Buddhist, it's very easy to look down on others whose sense of Buddha consciousness is not as evolved as yours. I had a friend in Toronto for a couple of years who was a Buddhist monk. And he, on a couple of occasions, said to me, he said, I have almost attained Buddha consciousness. Which, of course, led to the question, I was sort of too polite to ask it, does that make you superior to others who follow your religion? If you're a Hindu, you can look down on others whose karma is not as high as yours. And of course, built into Hinduism is the caste system. And particularly if you are at the bottom of that system and a so-called untouchable, you have a whole society looking down on you. Atheists are not immune from this. Incidentally, if you are an atheist, you can look down on those who are not as smart as you, especially those religious dumbasses. And if you are a Muslim, the religion I've been studying aside from my own for the past 20 years, well, of course, Islam is based on this idea that you keep the commandments and the Quran and Sharia law and so forth and acquire merit and blessing and righteousness and favor by keeping them. And of course, you can thus feel superior that your good deeds outweigh the pile of good deeds of the person next to you, and therefore you are more likely to go to heaven than they are because you are a more righteous person. Superiority is a huge problem for human beings. We all tend to play that game. And it's a particular problem if you are religious, and atheism functionally, for many people, behaves like a religion. There is only one exception to this pattern that I know of. There's only one exception to this pattern, and that's Christianity. Or at least Christianity as Jesus preached it. Because the thing that intrigues me is Jesus was probably, if you think about it, the most anti-religious founder of any religion in world history. Have you ever noticed this? In fact, it was interesting, as we were driving back to the hotel last night, Justin Trottier and I, as I said, we were talking about this topic, and he asked me, so what are you going to talk about in your talk on religion poisoning everything? I'm going to say, well, actually, I think religion's a bad thing. And he went, what? I went, well, I think Jesus was anti-religion. And what was really interesting, he looked at me and he went, that's interesting. That's intrigued me too. He said, he seemed to spend most of his time attacking religious people when I've read the Gospels. I was like, he did, didn't he, Justin? And unfortunately, we then got back to the hotel and the car ride was over. But interesting that my friend Justin had spotted this as well. Jesus spends most of his time attacking the religious leaders of his day. He calls them hypocrites. He calls them out for doing good and keeping the law just because it made them feel superior to others and increased their power. By contrast, Jesus attracted irreligious people. He was frequently criticized for this, remember, when you read the Gospels. He spent his time hanging out with tax collectors and prostitutes and lawyers and all kinds of people that he shouldn't have been hanging out with. Thank you. You got that last one. And consistently, right, Jesus said there's no point doing good deeds if your motives are wrong, if your heart isn't right. And you see, what intrigues me in all of this is that most people I meet, whether they are Christian or someone not necessarily just Christian, but some Christians, but certainly most other religions and most of my secular friends, many people I meet think that there are two ways to live. I meet so many people who think the choice is basically this. You can be irreligious and go off and be an atheist, or you can be religious and, you know, get serious about one of the world's faith traditions and so on and so forth. But the problem is that both of those ways up there lead to superiority and self-righteousness. If you take the irreligious route, if you are an atheist, well, it's been remarked, of course, that it's interesting that if you throw God out of the picture, what then tends to happen is you make yourself God, and you make yourself the center of the universe, and everything revolves around you. It all becomes about your opinions and your beliefs and your autonomy and your choices. A little bit of that came out last night in a couple of places. And that's quite problematic, actually, in terms of where that can lead you. Or, of course, if you go the religious route, then you fall into this trap quite quickly of beginning to look down on others because you think you're moral and superior and keep the law better than others and that you're nicer and holier and your British accent is better and so on and so forth. Most people think there are two ways to live, irreligion or religion. Both of them are devastating. Both of them lead to superiority. Both of them lead to excluding others. Both of them lead to intolerance and all manner of things. But what if there weren't just two ways to live? What if there weren't just two choices? What if there's a third choice? What if the third choice is the Jesus way? What if the choice were irreligion or religion, but actually the Jesus way? And of course, the message of Jesus, as I'm sure many of you realize, wasn't be a good person and God will like you. That's often the way it's mischaracterized. I have many secular friends who've picked that up somehow. That's what they think Christianity is about. I sometimes meet some churches that sort of accidentally seem to be preaching that. But the message of Jesus wasn't be a good person and God will like you. The radical message of Jesus was you don't have the power to be a good person. Your life is so broken and messed up and twisted and so forth, and you're so far from God that you don't have the ability to change how you live without radical inner transformation. And the way you get that radical transformation is by accepting that incredibly free gift of what Jesus offers when he paid for our brokenness on the cross, when he took that punishment that we deserved for our self-centeredness, our arrogance, our pride, our superiority. And the wonderful thing is when you grasp that, when you get the reality of the message of Jesus down into the very fiber of your being, down into your bones, down to your DNA, it destroys any basis for superiority and looking down on others. Because you have to conclude it's not about me, it's entirely about Jesus. And actually, the amazing thing as a Christian, it means you can look at your atheist friend and go, you are living a more moral life than I am. But it's not about morality. That's not what it's about. It's not about superiority. You know, Jesus was once asked, we talked about this last night a little bit actually, Jesus was once asked by a religious leader, which is the greatest commandment in all of the Jewish law? And as a good preacher and a good apologist, he didn't just give one answer, he gave two. And this is what Jesus said. Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 and through 40. Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and all of your soul and with all of your mind. And secondly, love your neighbor as yourself. All of the law and all of the prophets hang on these two commandments. Love God and love neighbor. These are connected, said Jesus, for a very, very good reason. It's from God that we derive our value and our purpose and our dignity. Without God, you would be nothing more than atoms dancing in the void. You'd be driven along by the same laws of physics and chemistry that constitute tables and Justin Bieber CDs and all the rest of things. Nothing more than atoms. Without God, the person sitting next to you in the auditorium this afternoon would have no value. She or he would just be a genetic puppet dancing to their DNA, as the atheist biologist Richard Dawkins memorably put it. On the other hand, if there is a God, everything changes. And the biblical basis, therefore, for not discriminating against others, for not behaving in ways that are superior, not looking down on others, not excluding people, not dividing people into them and ours, is simple. Love God and love neighbor. But it's also not just simple, it's also incredibly profound, because it's also personal. By which I mean, God simply hasn't sat up there in heaven and commanded that, but God has demonstrated that love and demonstrated that ethic in the person of Jesus Christ. And it was interesting that every other moral system in the world, whether it's a religiously based one or whether it's a secular based one like Justin's last night, is ultimately performance based. I don't know if you've noticed this. Keep these commandments, says Islam, and God will like you. Behave this way, you know, follow the tenets of secular humanism, and you'll be more moral, more progressive, more Canadian, more suitable for, you know, letting you loose in society, and so on and so forth. Do these things, keep these commandments, live this way, do this, and you'll be nicer, more likable, you know, more Canadian, and so forth. But what's interesting, have you noticed the common pattern there? It makes it all about us. My behavior, my hard work, my efforts, my achievements. And of course, that takes a direct line back into superiority. Because if it's all about my performance and my efforts, I can feel superior because look what I've achieved in terms of becoming this decent, upstanding citizen who stands before you this afternoon. No one sort of said yes at that point, so obviously I don't appear that way, but there we are. That's good. Christianity, by contrast, turns the whole thing around. Turns the whole thing around because Christian ethics is a response. Christianity doesn't say, keep these commandments, work, do all these things, and God will like you more. Christianity turns the whole thing around and goes, you can't earn your way into God's favor. And you can't make God love you more because he's already demonstrated how much he loves you when he came into history in the person of Jesus. And as the Bible says in Romans 5, verse 8, God demonstrates his love for us in this, while we were still sinners, while we were still rebels, while we were still outcasts, while we were God's enemies and wanted nothing to do with him. God demonstrated his love when he died in the person of Jesus on the cross. And then the Bible says, in the light of that, when you get that into your DNA, when you grasp that incredible love underpinning what God thinks about you, then says the Bible, in the light of that and how it's transformed you and changed you and empowered you through the gospel, then go and live differently. And it's because of what God has done in Jesus in my life that I have the motivation, I have the basis, I have the power. Yes, I mess it up from time to time, but then there's forgiveness too, to love others, even those who are vastly, radically different to me. If the gospel is true, it changes everything. If the gospel isn't true, nothing is changed. But thankfully, I believe that it is true. So go out there, find those who are different to you, love them with integrity and compassion. As you do, talk about the Jesus who makes it all possible. Thank you for listening. So patiently enjoy your tea break.